Chapter 2. The next few days hurtle by as fast as a motorcycle. As Toast hunts down information in the Citadel's records, Capable makes peace with the war boys, and Dag works on the farms, Cheeto is left to resolve the matter of scarcity. They have food from the farms on the first and the second tower, an aquifer full of water, and even some mother's milk, though not much, as only 11 of the 23 milking mothers elect to continue their work. But the supplies are not infinite. It's clear that all will get their fill of water, but food and milk are another problem altogether. Cheeto, with help from Toast, takes a census. In the first and second tower, there are 314 people. There are divers, war boys and pups, green thumbs, crane acrobats, wind farmers, tanners, who break down the bodies of the dead and honor them by using their bodies to help the rest survive. A few of the organic mechanics apprentices, the worm herders, and women. She has no information on the wretched in the third tower and down on the ground, but estimates that there are at least 1,000 of them. "Don't worry about the wretched until we figure out the situation in the third tower," Toast counsels. But Cheeto factors them in anyway. It's better to be safe than sorry. For now, Cheeto decides, water won't be rationed. Everyone will have enough to drink, though they're going to have to replace that awful dumping system that Joe used to use with the wretched. It's wasteful, even considering that the aquifer won't dry out anytime soon. But that will have to be a long-term plan, so Cheeto focuses on how they'll ration their food and milk. The Citadel has a varied diet, considering that it's in the middle of the desert. Scrub tells Cheeto that the terraces produced potatoes, sweet potatoes, onions, garlic, a few kinds of lettuce, turnips, and maize. And when Cheeto talks to the worm herders, who raise the mealworms and crickets, she finds that they've had a bumper harvest of insects. They have plenty of food, as long as it's rationed wisely. She hates herself, a little, for making these decisions. But until things get better, they're decisions she has to make. The healthiest people, the people who will be able to protect the Citadel, should the bullet farm or gas town send people to fight, or if marauders attack, have to get more. Their rations are larger. For now, pups exclusively get mother's milk, which is a decision that sits better with the milking mothers than passing it off to the grown war boys. Everyone else gets equal shares of food, both of plants and crickets and mealworms. That leaves some extra for when they manage to bring the third tower into the fold and unify with the wretched. At that point, they'll also have the third tower's resources, so Cheeto will have to recalculate to account for those. It's not much, and it's certainly not the best of plans, but Cheeto is relieved that when she presents it at an evening meeting, everyone agrees on the grounds that everyone will be receiving a fair portion at last. The next order of business is to get the wretched to join the rest of the Citadel. The last tower, with the elevators and the rest of the generators, has to be connected before they can go much further. A sense of urgency has taken hold of everyone. Things are peaceful for now, but this is the wasteland. Such a peace never truly lasts. It's the milking mothers who make the first overtures to the wretched. "We need to prove to them that things are different," Snake Tongue says, her look defying anyone to gainsay her. "We need to prove that there is more than water here." "Of course," Cheeto says. She draws her legs up beneath herself, tracing patterns in the dust on the floor. "What are you going to do?" "Some of the others have agreed to take the surplus mother's milk across to the third tower," Cat says. "There's enough to spare that we think all the children of the wretched can be fed." Cheeto's eyes widen. "That's good," she says, feeling a little breathless. "Have you told the others about the plan?"
"Not yet," Cat murmurs.
"Will they tell us not to go?" Snake Tongue's eyes flicker dangerously.
"I don't see why they would," Cheeto says.
"We all want the wretched to rejoin us." Cat plays with the hem of her veil.
"That's what they say, but is it true?"
Cheeto feels oddly hopeless. There have been so many lies in the past, but things have to change, or it will never get better.
"I'll stand by you," she says instead of answering. It might not be true, but Cheeto wants it to be. Snake Tongue nods.
Then we'll speak to everyone else, she says.
Toast is shocked that night when shy little Cheeto opens the floor for Cat and Snake Tongue. It's not unheard of for Cheeto to speak in meetings, but she doesn't usually do something so bold. Then again, this is the third time that Cheeto has spoken up like this. Maybe she's finally growing up a bit. The two women present their plan to take surplus milk to the third tower for the wretched children. There are liters of milk available, the women reassure them. There will be enough for all. They've been taking some off and setting it aside without telling anyone else for a while now. For a second, Toast is irritated that they didn't give her accurate numbers for the records, but she pushes that aside. It was for a good cause, and besides, they're the ones who dictate how milk is rationed. Toast doesn't have a say in that, and neither does anyone else.
I think it's a good plan, Scrub pipes up. She tucks up her shoulders when everyone looks at her, but keeps talking.
We need to get into the other farms. And besides, some of the Green Thumbs and Crane Acrobats have family in the Wretched. We haven't seen them in years.
What about the divers? Toast asks Rush, the woman who oversees the aquifer.
Family?
If they aren't dead, we'd like a chance to find out if they're alive.
Rush murmurs. She, like Jacker, needs a cane. She's no older than Toast, but all those years down in the dark have left her bones brittle and her hips aching.
Capable looks around. So we're agreed to send milk to the Wretched? She asks.
There are murmurs of assent. The war boys look uncertain, as they always do when the milking mothers speak. They're trying very hard to think of the women as people, but it's obviously an adjustment.
We'll go tomorrow, Snake Tongue says.
And they do. As the sun cracks over the horizon, a group of women makes their way across the swaying bridge to the doors of a third tower. Snake Tongue and Cat lead the way, with Cheeto on their heels, and five of the other milking mothers behind that, and Rush behind them. Each of the women has a large clay jar of milk balanced carefully on her head. Toast brings up the rear, long-sufferingly carrying a gun just in case. Furiosa told her to take it, and Toast acknowledges the wisdom of bringing it. Unlike in the second tower, the doors here are thrown wide open. It's more quiet than Toast expected as they enter the warren. No one is around, and the tunnels, despite the presence of 1,000 wretched, are completely empty. But then again, it's very early. They might be sleeping still, in the secret places that riddle the towers. They come out into a huge atrium, where the war rig and other great vehicles used to be kept, and all of the women stop. They're on a balcony, a ledge that rings the room with steps going down, and on the floor, and all around the ledge are packed wretched. It's a calm assembly. People of all ages, emaciated and obviously dehydrated, and entirely not what Toast expected. This isn't a riot. This is a community. As soon as they come in, people notice. But no one moves. They stare, cautious but not hostile, until a thin woman of great age, with brown skin as thin as linen, rises to her feet in the middle of the mass and addresses them.
Why are you here?
She asks, in a quavering voice that rings like a bell.
We brought mother's milk, Snake Tongue says, and sets down her large jug.
The old woman navigates the silent crowd, climbing the steps with resolute and trembling legs. She's as tall as Toast when she reaches the ledge and looks down into Snake Tongue's jug. Then she looks up at Snake Tongue.
Did the Immortan send you? She asks flatly.
Cheeto's heart drops through her feet. She sets down her jug with a thud and steps forward, beside Snake Tongue, looking the old woman in the eyes.
The Immortan Joe is dead, she says.
I know, the old woman says, and holds up a desiccated finger on a string around her neck. I have proof of that much, at least. Cheeto can't suppress a shudder, but doesn't let the disgust stop her.
So you know that there's no Immortan now?
There's a new one, we hear, the old woman says. Amortin Furiosa, isn't that right?
It makes Cheeto sick to hear that.
No, she says loudly. Furiosa isn't a new ruler. We have a council now, and we're all helping make decisions.
No one ordered us to come here, Snake Tongue says, projecting her voice so the whole massive auditorium will hear. We made that decision ourselves. We brought milk to feed the children.
The old woman studies them for a moment.
We don't have many children, she says shrewdly.
Then we'll feed the sickest among you, Cat says gently, to help them get well again.
Another long moment of silence passes. Cheeto shrinks under the old woman's scrutiny, but at last she nods.
All right, she says. Carry it down and feed the children.
And they do. The wretched, who are better groomed now, clean since the water is still falling into the great plateau between the towers, make space for the jugs of milk. The lines are unexpectedly orderly, as parents push their children forward to take milk. Cheeto feels ashamed of herself for thinking so little of these people, and they are people, no less than anyone in the other two towers.
The old woman appears suddenly before Cheeto. What manner of creature are you? She asks. Cheeto almost wants to laugh, startled as she is.
I was one of the breeders, she says.
The treasure of the Citadel, the old woman mutters. She peers at Cheeto. Her eyes have cataracts but are still remarkably sharp.
He took one of my daughters, long ago, but I don't know what happened to her.
I wish I could tell you, Cheeto says. She glances at the floor. But I wasn't there long at all.
The old woman sticks her hand out.
I'm Ginny, she says.
Cheeto takes her bony hand.
Cheeto.
The rest of them, Ginny says, waving at the wretched around them, told me to be the leader, because I'm the oldest, and I have the loudest voice. That counts for a lot.
I've noticed, Cheeto says, glancing at Toast and thinking of Angharad.
So you want us to join the rest of the Citadel? Ginny asks.
Cheeto nods.
It would be good for all of us, she says.
Ginny wrinkles her lip.
I can't speak for all of them, she says, but I'd like to join.
We have water and food in plenty, Cheeto says. She clasps her hands, trying to stop them from trembling.
No one will be less than anyone else. We just want...
You want something better, Ginny says, nodding slowly.
Well, I think it's a fine idea. I'll spread it around, we'll give it some talk, see if we all agree.
Cheeto summons up a smile.
Thank you, she says.
For the first time since they fled the Citadel, Cheeto truly feels a sense of hope. Up on the terraces, the Dag bends over the growing plants and brushes their leaves with her fingertips. They're soft to the touch, these little potato leaves, weak for now, but growing stronger very quickly.
You love plants more than anyone I've ever seen, Scrub says.
The Dag straightens, pressing her hands into the small of her back.
They're better than people, most of the time, she says.
Scrub smiles ruefully.
That's true. Don't want anything from you. Won't hurt you.
You're lucky to be a green thumb.
The Dag relinks her arm with Scrub's, and the two walk side by side down the rows of greenery. They pass potatoes, onions, turnips, and the rest. The Dag already thinks of them as old and familiar friends. The sun is strong and hot today, but the Dag doesn't mind. This is good weather for growing.
It is lucky, Scrub says. But only now. You know that we used to not be allowed to eat anything we grew up here?
The Dag shakes her head and spits.
Scraggle Snag wanted it all for himself, she mutters.
They duck under an arch and into the cool shade of one of the tunnels. Here, The pipes that connect to the drip sprinklers gather together and burrow down to the main aquifer. The women pause to enjoy the cool. There's weeding to do. Somehow, even after all this time, undesirable plants have hung on and grow in the soil of the terraces. But even those don't go to waste. When the barrows are full, they'll give all the unwanted plants to the worm herders to feed the crickets and mealworms.
"You have more seeds," Scrub says, after a moment of companionable quiet.
"A whole bag full," the Dag agrees. Scrub tilts her head.
"You'll plant them?"
"Maybe," the Dag says. She thinks of that bag, with its packets and labels of all kinds of strange plants, not just food plants, that she's never seen before. It's tucked away in a secret place, so no one disturbs it. She's almost afraid to plant them. What if the soil's too sour, even here?
"We could mark a special plot for them," Scrub says thoughtfully. "Keep them away from the main crops. Just a few. As in, what do you call it?"
"An experiment," the Dag says.
Scrub grins. She's still got most of her teeth, which is an accomplishment.
"Yeah," she says. "An experiment. I'd love to see some new green things. Unless you don't want my help."
"Of course I want your help." The Dag takes Scrub's hand. "You're the green thumb. And you're my friend."
Scrub looks startled.
"Friend?
What, never had a friend before?" The Dag scoffs. She squeezes Scrub's hand tightly.
"It's time you had one, then."
"All right," Scrub says, a trace of her old shyness creeping into her voice.
"Will your other friends mind? Me and you being friends?"
The Dag tosses her hair.
"If they do mind, which I don't think they will, then they'll just have to find some other friends of their own, won't they?"
Scrub nods.
"Right, they will."
"Then it's settled," the Dag says. "We're bossum friends. Forever."
"Forever,"
Scrub echoes. They turn and go back out onto the terraces, side by side. As they weed, they talk and laugh, freer and happier than the Dag has been for thousands and thousands of days. It's strange, this feeling. But she supposes it's what her sisters have been speaking of for all this time. It feels like green things, taking root and growing in her. Hope is alive and well in her, even after all this time.
Furiosa is very tired of being bedridden. She can't get up and walk much, or for very long, but she's determined to get better. The organic mechanic's apprentice, a young, skinny, wiry individual who is apparently neither a man nor a woman, takes her determination in stride, and comes up with a crutch she can use to support herself before too long. She hobbles around the room, frustrated by the lack of balance from her newly missing arm and the pain in her side, refusing to stop even when capable worries.
"I'm fine," Furiosa insists. And really, she is. She's endured far worse in far uglier places than this. The Citadel is already better, though it's barely been 2 10-days since their return. The ration plan Cheeto invented is working fine, even as the Wretched began to join the rest of the Citadel. A detail of war boys is working in the machine shops, trying to get the remaining vehicles back in order. Capable is teaching pups to read, along with some of the former milking mothers. The Dag is already experimenting with some of the seeds from the Keeper's satchel, advised by Scrub and some of the other Green Thumbs. Toast and Snake Tongue are searching for anything relevant in the Citadel's records, turning up lineages and blood types and the locations of supply caches locked deep in the Warrens. Amid all of this, Furiosa feels useless. She can't do war, not when they don't have cars. She can't be an Imperator, not when other people are rationing supplies and manning their few guns. All she can be is a burden, a waste of resources. It's a simple fact, but Furiosa doesn't bring it up. The wives, the sisters, as people began to call them, won't hear of anyone being a resource drain.
They're already arguing that being part of the Citadel shouldn't have anything to do with skills and talents.
People don't need a purpose to exist, Toast proclaims to no one on a particularly charged evening. In Furiosa's opinion, these are pointless words. Jacker, the de facto leader of the remaining war boys, has made his feelings clear already. Rush is clear that no one should be denied water, whether or not they're good at anything. Scrub has said that the Green Thumbs will feed everyone.
Thinning is for plants, not people, she said when the Dag asked her. The Milking Mothers think the same way, and of course old Ginny believes it.
Furiosa thinks they're idiots.
The Citadel has limited resources. This is a fact. And as much as she'd like to feed every one of the wretched and give them all safety, it just won't work. But since no one will listen, Furiosa keeps her mouth shut and focuses on recovery. She wants to believe that things will get better. But in truth, she doesn't think that they ever will.
It's more than 2 10-days since they returned, and one of the lookouts sounds the alarm. In the vault, where Furiosa was irritably resting, klaxons sound. Furiosa almost falls off the cot, seizing her crutch and limping as fast as she can out to the balcony where Joe used to preach. A few of the others are already there, but Furiosa ignores them in favor of the young woman at the telescope.
"What's happening?" she snaps.
The woman steps back, pushing the telescope towards Furiosa.
"A dust cloud. Bikers," she says.
Furiosa stares through the telescope at the glaring horizon. There's definitely a dust cloud, and she can see the vague shapes of motorcycles in the fog.
"Rock riders wouldn't come so close," Jacker says, somewhere behind her.
"Maybe not when Joe was here," Toast says, "but he's not here now."
When Furiosa turns, she sees Snake Tongue frowning.
"Did any rock riders survive the first battle in the canyon?" the woman asks, stepping in for a turn at the telescope.
"I didn't think so," Furiosa says grimly.
She turns to Toast and Jacker. Capable Cheeto, the Dag, and several others have come in, all asking questions and looking worried. But it's Toast who knows the exact numbers on their ammunition and weapons, and it's Jacker who's aware of how many war boys are in fighting shape and how many cars they have ready for a fight. She doesn't even have to ask.
"We're ready," Toast says. "There's enough ammunition for a skirmish, and we have more explosive lances than I thought."
"Three cars," Jacker says,
"and enough war boys to crew 'em."
Furiosa doesn't hesitate. She hands her crutch to Capable, who tries to push it back.
"You can't just..." Capable starts.
"I have to," Furiosa says.
She looks back at Toast and Jacker. Toast is holding a gun. Holding it right, Furiosa is pleased to see. Someone's been teaching her. And Jacker has straightened up, swinging his rebar cane over his shoulder, ready for a fight. The war boys are eager when Furiosa comes into the garage, walking like her side isn't killing her, and announces that they're riding out.
"I thought you weren't going to be an Imperator anymore,"
Toast mutters to Furiosa while the crews tear around getting ready.
"I'm not," Furiosa says, watching the hustle. "But this is all I'm good for."
She takes the front car, a jacked-up former pickup that clearly wasn't good enough to be a pursuit vehicle, but will do now. Toast and Jacker join her, standing in the bed while she takes shotgun in the cab. Furiosa has a rifle in her good arm. If she steadies it right, she'll be able to fire just as well as she used to. The driver, a young war boy who's barely out of his pup days, is obviously awed to be sharing a cab with her, but she ignores it. They ride out of the Citadel into the desert, intending to meet the bikers head-on. It might only be 3 cars, but that should be at least enough to frighten rock riders away. They're bandits, opportunists, not warriors. Furiosa sights down the barrel of the rifle. It lacks a proper scope, but her eyes are good, and it will do. Ahead, the dust cloud is growing in size. Furiosa can make out the shapes of 3 motorcycles, each with at least 1 rider. It's vague, but something about this doesn't seem right. These aren't rock riders. They can't be.
It's only when the dust clears for a moment and she sees the flash of a familiar silhouette that Furiosa understands what's happening. She commands the driver to stop in the voice of an imperator, and he does, confused. The other two cars nearly crash into them, but Furiosa pays the chaos no mind. Toast yells at her, demanding to know what's going on, but Furiosa ignores it as she tosses the rifle aside and bails out of the cab. The motorcycles aren't far off, and as Furiosa scrambles over the sand towards them, she knows that she was right. She shouts, wordless, and is rewarded with a cry of joy from one of the riders. Three women, dressed in tattered clothes, leap from the bikes as they skid to a halt 15 feet away. Valkyrie sprints across the sand, sunburned and beautiful and so very alive, and crashes into Furiosa. And for the first time since she woke up in the Citadel, Furiosa feels hope burning in her heart. "It was an accident that we survived," Maddie explains to the council. "And it's taken us some time to gather our strength enough to come back." "We had no idea whether or not you'd succeeded," Joan says from her cot. She's badly injured, but Capable's heart sings every time she looks at the woman. That Joan managed to survive the fight in the desert is an inspiration for the future of the Citadel. Valkyrie, sitting beside Furiosa with an arm around her shoulders, smiles. "It's good to find you all whole," she says. And though she looks around the circle, Capable has the distinct sense that she's speaking directly to her friend. "What do you want from us?" Jacker asks. Maddie shrugs. "Place to stay? Some of that water?" "You're welcome here, you know," Kat says. "I'd like to see those gardens up top," Joan says thoughtfully, glancing up at the glass ceiling of the vault. "But I don't think I want much else." "Everyone is welcome here," Capable says, before someone more cynical can respond to Joan's comment. "Whether they want something or not." That forms the core of one of the struggles of creating a functional leadership structure in the new Citadel. Opinions generally tend to say that everyone deserves food and water and shelter, but people are divided on how voices ought to be heard. There are too many people for a direct democracy to be a good idea, but no one wants to go back to the old ways of an Immortan as a god king. Ginny won't hear of a permanent council making decisions. "You mark my words, it won't be long before some people have more than others, and we're back where we started." Toast thinks informal laws are best, and they don't need to write anything down. Maddie throws books across the vault when Toast starts in on this particular argument. Furiosa is of the clear opinion that only people with useful skills ought to be allowed to be part of the decision-making process. And although everyone disagrees with her, it's hard not to hear the logic in her argument. Though Jacker proposes a system where each faction sends representatives to a council, he's shouted down because they're trying to establish unity, not put the entire Citadel into a hierarchy again. Finally, after many days of debate and deliberation, Snake Tongue puts forward the idea of a lottery. "Anyone who lives at the Citadel can be chosen to sit on the council," she says. "You serve for a 10-day, and then someone else comes and takes your place." "How many people?" the DAG asks. "And how are they chosen?" Snake Tongue consults her notes. "I thought 15, she says. "Chosen at random from the whole population. And these are the people who actually make decisions, if decisions need to be made. They'll take advice from the people who know what they're about, like Scrub or Rush." "What about war?" Furiosa asks. "The buzzards will be back eventually." "The council won't direct war," Snake Tongue says. She eyes Furiosa and Valkyrie and glances at Toast. "You three will." "What? Me?" Toast's eyes pop. Capable can't help a little laugh. "Of course you," she says. "You can hold a gun, and you can drive a car, and the war boys like you." "If war boy opinions are what counts, then really it should be you doing war," Toast grumbles. But she looks pleased at the compliments to her skills. Capable smiles and leans her shoulder against the other woman's. "It'll keep anyone from trying to get special privileges, because they'll be out of the council in just a 10-day, Snake Tongue says,
and they won't be able to be on the council twice in a row.
I like the sound of that, Ginny says unexpectedly. She folds her arms.
But what can't the council do? What's to stop them deciding that someone should be snapped or kicked out?
Cheeto leans forward.
I think the council isn't allowed to snap anybody, she says. And they can only kick people out for murder or taking more than they're supposed to have.
We need to write that down, Maddie says, with a raised eyebrow aimed at Toast.
Sure, whatever, Toast says, rolling her eyes.
Get someone to scratch it on a rock. That'll make it so much more powerful.
It will, you know, Capable says, thinking of all the people who are learning to read now. There are ideas free in the air of the Citadel, and it's exhilarating just listening sometimes. The ideas are coming, she knows, from the books that more and more people are trying to read.
Scrub, hip to hip with Dag, asks, when will we do the first lottery?
I say we announce it now, and do it in a 10-day, Rush says. Get people excited, and we can also get all the names we need.
I don't think anyone who directs war should sit on the council, Furiosa says suddenly.
Capable draws back a bit, surprised.
Why not?
Because that's how things got bad in the old days, Valkyrie says. She rests her elbows on her knees. Her voice takes on the sense of someone reciting a powerful myth. Men who did war could also make laws. And then they made war into a law, and no one could stop them.
So war boys won't sit on the council?
Jacker spits on the floor and crosses his arms, challenging the rest of the group.
Nah, won't have no part in that.
War boys can be on the council, Furiosa says. But I can't. And neither can Valkyrie, or Toast, or you. But Kez could.
I could?
Kez asks, finally looking up from the corner where he's busy touching up his white paint.
Me? Making decisions for the Citadel?
The Dag grins.
Sounds preposterous, doesn't it? But I like the idea of just being able to work in the gardens.
She's got dirt under her fingernails, and she's carrying her baby with more grace than Capable has ever seen her do anything else.
Jacker looks satisfied by that. With no other objections, they send Capable to find someone willing to carve the new laws into a wall.
She goes with a bounce in her step, convinced that things are finally going to get really, truly better. It's been 400 days since the establishment of the new Citadel. Since the new laws were carved on walls in each tower, since the future became the present. Green is spilling down off the sides of the towers now, terraces added to each one to expand the amount of farming they can do. An aqueduct has been constructed, carrying water from tower to tower. The barriers between each group are still breaking down, but they are coming down, piece by piece. Rush found her family among the citizens, as the wretched are now called. As, it's true, all of them are now called. They're citizens first, and war boys, divers, farmers, mothers second. There are no titles, no hierarchies. Rather than standing as a blight of pain on the wasteland, the Citadel has become an oasis of equality. It wasn't long after the new council was drawn that the Bullet Farm and Gas Town made overtures of peace. It has been a tense series of negotiations, especially since they'd been led by 15 people drawn at random. But it had gone well. The council, a crane acrobat, a diver, a war boy, and 12 once wretched, had been firm in refusing to reinstate anything that looked anything like the old ways. In the end, they'd re-establish trade, but it was true trade, and not the system of tithes and taxes that the Immortan used to use. Furiosa had been surprised, considering that 12 of the counselors had not a single special skill to their names. But the success of that encounter had convinced her that it was all right to use this lottery system. Dag bore a girl and named her, as it felt only appropriate to all of them, Hope. She took her turn as one of the milking mothers, as so many women do now, of their own free will.
Cheeto offered to help raise the Sprog, since she had none of her own yet, and wouldn't for quite some time. The two of them are good parents, constantly by each other's side. Furiosa thinks that Capable might soon have the chance to have a Sprog of her own, considering the way that she keeps looking at Jacker. And Toast, who has absolutely no interest in any of that, is happy working on her car. They have more cars now, since over time they'd gone out into the desert and retrieved as many pieces of the wrecked cars that they could. It's not a fleet the size of the one that Joe used to command, but it's certainly stronger than they had been. A few skirmishes with buzzards and other marauders happen on occasion, but nothing like the war in the past. Though the war boys are still called war boys, they have more to do now in improving the Citadel's infrastructure than going out and doing war. And they seem disinclined to go out with the same veracity they used to, now that they have a life to live for. It had been a shocking discovery when Maddie and Ginny realized that the white paint that the war boys used was full of lead and depleted uranium. The paint that they thought gave them power was what was actually killing them. It had been tossed out into the desert, and suddenly, the war boys stopped growing tumors and having night fevers. The pups, who are being raised as children should and not as battle fodder, will not be half-lives like their older brothers. Furiosa thinks of all of this as she climbs the stairs to the greenhouse, where the unlocked vault still sits. The door is never shut or locked anymore, and it is used as a quiet place for reflection and prayer, rather than as a prison cell. She's not surprised to see that the sisters, as they are called now, have gathered here. They often do. Even in this new citadel, they have a certain status. These were the women whose actions forced the change, whose choices saved this small corner of the wasteland. Though the vault is open to all, a reminder of what the citadel once was and what it is now, it is known that this is their place. They have the most claim to it. Furiosa, Capable exclaims, setting down her book and standing to welcome her. Didn't expect to see you today, Toast says, looking up from the schematics she's studying. We got war to worry about? Buzzards? Furiosa shrugs. No, she says. I just wanted to get out of the garage. This is a good place to be, Cheeto says, cradling Little Hope on her lap. From her spot on the step, Dag grins. Best place, if you ask me, she says. She looks around the vault, and Furiosa follows her gaze. Someone has carved over the chalk that the women had used to write their messages to the Immortan, leaving the words permanently in the stone of the citadel. Our babies will not be warlords. Who killed the world? We are not things. Words that serve as the foundation of the new citadel, carved into walls that are no longer a prison. It's a lot better than it used to be, Furiosa concedes. This is how it all began, she remembers. The sisters, sitting around discussing ideas of a better world, trying to turn this corner of hell into a green place of their own. One of them is missing, but Furiosa feels her presence in the words on the wall, in the baby Cheeto holds, in the very air of the citadel. Angharad would be proud of us, Capable says, echoing Furiosa's thoughts. This is what she wanted, all along. We all wanted it, Toast says. A better world. A kinder world, Cheeto murmurs. A greener world, the Dag says. Furiosa smiles. A world built on hope. The end. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. This podfic, as well as all of my other works, can be found at archiveofourown.org/users/schmaler. Comments and kudos are always appreciated.